This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And phone line, text line open for you at 343-0106. Get all choked up about this because it was a lot of fun. Last time Sarah Kalian joined me in studio, we had just met that time, maybe just minutes before the interview started. And I was like, wow, it's a lot to this. And good to have you back. And let's talk about events where people can meet you in person. I'm going to get you right in front of that mic where they can see you. And also your continuing relationship with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm really excited.
So you're back. You got some shows coming up as well?
Yeah. So this trip is actually kind of a quick little one, but I'm doing two live events here in town. I'm doing one tonight at Iron Hand Brewery downtown.
That's where you were last time.
That was where we did last time. And it seemed to be pretty successful. We had a line around the block to get in. So it was a good start to the Mobile shows. And that show tonight is going to be, it's a Halloween theme, but I do things a little different. There's nothing supernatural about it. What the show is going to be about is all cases, real cases that took place on Halloween, kind of throughout history, all over the country.
Is there something to that, or is there not? I mean, like, if you had to look at, is there a chart? This whole subject when we talk with you it's all scary stuff. But are there Halloween crimes more than there are like June crimes? Does it?
Not necessarily, no. And in fact, we're going to see that as we go through the show tonight. We're going to talk about seven or eight different cases going all the way back to like the 1800s and coming all the way up to 1980. And we're going to see in those that some of them, it was just random. It just happened to be that was on the date that the murder took place. There have been a couple, though, where the killer very deliberately planned it. It didn't have anything to do with Halloween, but they planned the crime to happen on Halloween in order to kind of cover up what they were doing to help along with the process of the crime.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I want to kind of back up too. I said cold case investigator, but people who have not been out to a live show or didn't hear you last time with us, you have a career in law enforcement, and then you move into still law enforcement, but you're a cold case investigator. Are you what do you call your job? I mean, you come in and you assist other. You don't work for the department full time. You're a contractor. What was the term?
Yeah, sort of something like that. So basically, I was a just a regular old police officer. I got to drive fast and yell at people in the middle of the night, and then became a sex crimes detective. And I did that for about 10 years. But I had always had a fascination with these serial offenders, and so I eventually left commissioned work to do academic research. And I did about another then kind of 10 years of just focusing on the research, particularly on criminal psychology, and just learning as much as I could about a particular brand of criminal psychology, and that is the serial rapist and the serial killer. And so now I just kind of like I have all this stuff in my brain, and I'm not a half bad investigator, particularly with these types of cases. And so sometimes it will be like a nonprofit organization that works to clear cold cases, or in some cases wrongful conviction cases and stuff like that. And then in some cases like this, where Mobile County Sheriff's Office has a team that said, hey, if you want to take a peek at some of our cold cases and see if any of them are kind of in your area of expertise, and then maybe we can work together. That's what the relationship here is. I'm very, very lucky to work with this team. They're incredible.
Term cold case gets thrown out there. Of course, people will hear your voice and probably go, I have seen her on TV. I've heard her on podcasts. So you do all this. You talk about cold case. What is it, a cold case? I'm saying, is it in just that they've closed the books on it, or it's happened a certain number of years, statute of limitation?
Everybody, I think probably you could ask every investigator and probably even every single jurisdiction if they had a specific definition, and they might. It might be a certain number of years without activity, something like that. To me, it is just a case where the original investigation has kind of hit a dead end, has hit a wall, and the investigators on that team are, they've constantly got new stuff coming at them. And so it becomes a matter of we're stalled out on this and we don't really have the resources to devote the time necessary to get unstuck, right? To get those tires out of the mud and see a new direction. And that's where I can come in because I can say, okay, I'm going to work on this one case until we get some traction on it again.
And you would have a tough time doing that with somebody who's commissioned because there's new stuff coming in every day.
100%. Okay. And they're getting new stuff all the time that requires fresh attention in order for it to keep from getting cold.
All right. This is, as you work on these cases here for Mobile County, talk about kind of what cases you're working on, what's leading. You and I talked about a murder investigation from way back.
We're still working on that one, believe it or not.
And this is the case of
1993, the murder of Renee Bergeron.
1993.
But that's the other thing too, is that Law and Order has deceived us all into believing that a murder happens and or an assault happens and the victim still has fresh bruises by the time they're testifying. So to be honest, we've been, especially Captain Birch and Detective Peak and I have been working on this case now for 2.5 straight years, which feels like an eternity and probably seems like it from the outside. But in all honesty, we've made incredible strides in that time. And we certainly feel much closer to a resolution than at any time previous in the nearly 30 years.
What I remember off the top of my head, this was a heinous dismembering crime,
right? Yeah, dismembering mutilation. Just absolutely atrocious.
And they had, didn't they say they thought at first it might have been a drug deal gone bad or something like that? And then I think I heard you say in an interview that didn't fit the, and it made sense what I heard you say. I'm like, yeah, what drug dealer is going to take time to dismember somebody?
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to even lay blame at the feet of the investigators at the time necessarily. There are things that I would imagine we would do very differently now in a lot of aspects. But that we also have tools. Some of them are scientific tools like evidence collection and DNA type stuff. But some of them are just a better understanding of what type of killer commits what type of crime. And that just wasn't necessarily as widely understood in the 90s. Believe it or not, people didn't really, what we know as profiling had not really taken hold. That had really not taken hold. I mean, the real research on that was done primarily in the 70s and early 80s. And so it was only barely understood in the FBI by the time that Renee was murdered. And so it's not the fault of the investigators that they looked at this. I mean, she had had a history of some drug use, so it sort of made sense. Like, well, some drug dealers are bad guys, and let's just go that route. Knowing what we know now, we look at that crime scene, and it's pretty clear right from the get-go. It had nothing to do with drugs, or even possibly with any sort of sex work or anything like that.
So looking at this as a profiler, can I call you your profiler,
absolutely,
right? Cold case investigator profiler. So you then take this study that you did, and you have this information in your head. Then I'm picturing here comes the cold case in one side of the head, and you're filtering,
yep,
right? You're filtering to say more yes or more no's. Are you, when you see something, are you saying I'm going to discount or I'm going to include? You see what I'm saying at first?
You're actually throughout the process, you're going to do all of that. I kind of think of it at this stage. I've been doing this long enough and studying this very kind of narrow niche of criminals long enough that to me, it's almost like a second language, right? So if you're fluent in a language, you don't hear a conversation and think to yourself, okay, this word means this and this word means that.
Right, you just
you
know
simply
it.
Understand it.
Makes sense.
And so to me, I can generally look at a case, particularly if it looks, like there is a sexual homicide component to it or a serial component to it. I can look at it and understand the language that crime scene is speaking to me.
When we talk about serial crimes and people, serial in order, numbers of them, but does that discount or does it include or discount somebody knowing the victim? Is there, when we hear serial killer, serial rapist, does that mean that the victims are unknown to them, or does that not even?
So it's no, not necessarily. And part of that
kind of random component we often think we hear serial killer, we think it's completely random.
Completely random. But there are, and that is true to a certain extent. I mean, it's never random to the killer, but it may be random to the victim, right? Yeah. Like they didn't know this person or anything. Like it's a stranger attack. But that's not always the case too, particularly early in the career of somebody who will become a serial predator. They often start on somebody that they know. It's almost like practicing in an area that you're comfortable with or you have more confidence in. And so we will sometimes see behaviors that look like a serial, but it may even be their first or only second offense because they may know the victim. There are other elements to it too, in that is that, you know, the FBI definition of serial is quite simply just two or more homicide offenses with a particular cooling down period, right? But
if they killed two people in the same night, that's not
that. Then is either a mass or a spree, depending on some of the other factors. But the ones that I tend to focus on, the ones that I and I think most profilers and even the folks at the BSU and the FBI and everything, what we think of as kind of the real capital S, capital K serial killers are ones with a sexual homicide component. And it's I know it's the middle of the day. Yeah. People are like in their cars with their kids. Sorry about that.
Kids should be in school.
But that's what it means when we're examining these guys, is that there is something about it for them that was a particular jolly. And it doesn't always even mean that the victim was sexually assaulted in a way that we understand. It simply means that for that killer, that was part of the magic, so to speak.
Oh,
I know. It's a weird, dark world.
Yeah, you chose to do it. But listen, we're coming back from the break. You chose to do this, but the legions of people that are fascinated by what you do maybe still surprises you. It surprises me. It's amazing. People have a chance tonight, Iron Hand Brewery, come out and
yes,
see you.
Yes, and Thursday, I'll actually be at the Historic Preservation Society of Mobile. This one tonight is all the Halloween cases. That one is the case I did here last time, Blood on the Bayou, so it's all Gulf Coast.
We'll talk
cases.
More about that when we come back. More with Sarah Kaley and our guest right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Great. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have Sarah Kaley back in studio. It's been, like, was it last year?
Oh, it was July.
July, okay.
It hasn't been that long.
Gosh, it seems like.
I know.
Wow. Back tonight at Iron Hand Brewery, starting at what time?
7 p.m.
Can I get tickets ahead of time, or can you show up?
I believe you can get tickets ahead of time online. You can either go to Iron Hand's Facebook site, or you can go to my website. All my events are up there, and
where is that?
KaleinInvestigations.com. Nice and simple. CAILEAN, investigations.com.
All right, and then you said the History Museum in Mobile is going to be on Thursday
night, yep.
So that starts at, you know.
That one, I believe, starts at 6 p.m. And again, you think I'd be better at this. I've been kind of all over the country doing events in different venues around different cities. So I'm kind of, it's all starting to bleed together. But I believe their Instagram page is the best place to find that.
Okay. Speaking of that, it's like last time you joined me, like we were introduced pretty soon before we went on the air. And then we had a great conversation. And then the time being, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like, y'all know Sarah, like from podcasts out there and TV shows out there, that Hell in the Heartland? Or
yes, sir. Yeah, on HLN. It's actually on HBO Max now, so I feel like I've really made the big time.
There you go. You're in the upper, the 300 channel,
that's
sir.
Right.
As you talk about working here with Mobile, so you have come in now, you're former law enforcement, but you're a civilian now.
Yep.
You come in and you do you pick cases, or do they say, hey, Sarah, we need help on these cases? How, like the Rene Bergeron, like how did you pick that one?
The way this one went, I sat down with Captain Birch, who is, you know, obviously he's the head of major crimes. And we had talked about it. We had batted it around a little bit together because I'd gotten to know him when working on Hell in the Heartland, actually, because we were looking at Jeremy Jones, you know, who Captain Birch had captured when the entire country's law enforcement seemed to fail to be able to catch this
People
man.
Forget that. We know that Jones as being this local story, but it was way bigger than here.
It was way bigger than that. He had killed a number of people in Oklahoma, in Georgia, in Louisiana, probably more that, oh, Kansas, probably more that we don't know about. He also had committed a whole series of just brutal sexual assaults. He's a really bad dude. And he just kept slipping through the fingers. He first was getting a lot of probations from different places, which is insane to me. And then I think in part because he was working as an informant for state investigators, there was a lot of turning the other way. And then it was like, oh, he's worse than we thought. So then he fled and he lived under an assumed name, and he continued killing women through the Deep South. And in the meantime, the FBI had entered his fingerprints into the system incorrectly when he was wanted. So he was stopped by police numerous times in those years and just sent on his way. And, you know, nobody seemed to be able to capture this guy. And then he got here and he committed a terrible rape and murder. And inside of a week, Captain Birch had him behind bars. So, you know, people here should definitely feel really lucky to have a team like that, because Jones would have kept going. I mean, there's nothing that stops a guy like him.
Except law enforcement.
Except really good law enforcement. Yeah, exactly. And so we had met working on that. And when we were kind of wrapping that up, he said, you know, I said, oh, I'd love to look at some of your cold cases. And he said, come on down. And just sort of, he had pulled out a list of the ones, that, you know, that were kind of sitting in files and still cold. And we poked around a couple of them. And then I saw the Bergeron one and I said, oh, this is one of my guys. This looks like somebody that I might be able to.
One of your guys mean the kind of people that you see that you're profiling.
Right.
That it's
somebody who this is going to fall under the realm of serial killer or serial sexual homicide. You know, that's what I mean when I say my guys. I obviously don't mean it affectionately.
No,
I mean, these are the people that I've studied. And so I want to be as useful as possible. You know, otherwise it's just
me. This is your expertise. This is your super friend. You know, this is where you are.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I saw that case and I said, oh, this is the one.
So, okay. So you start looking into this. We're talking about a case from 1993. You're trying. I'm just going to ask you something bluntly. As you try to find witnesses or people with information, 93, it doesn't seem that long ago, but if somebody was older in 93, they may not be with us anymore or not remember what.
We've definitely hit brick walls on a couple of witnesses who potentially could have been really, really great, who were deceased. One, in fact, well, it was a very frustrating day when we, you know, saw in the original notes the name of a woman who had been with Renee several times through that week leading up to her death. And we thought, this is somebody mm-hmm. we really want to talk to. And we discovered that not only was she dead, she had also been murdered.
Really?
About 10 years later. Yeah. And so that's another one that I've kind of like set that folder aside. And I've said to Detective Peake and Captain Birch, like, I want to kind of start on this one next when we close Renee's.
When you open up a case like this or, you know, cold case, you reach out to family members? Do you?
100%. I would never
say,
either.
Hey.
Yep. Yep. It's actually the first thing we do. So that day that I found this case among, you know, Captain Birch's many files, that night I spent a few hours online hunting down some family members. It was not terribly hard. I mean, her now grown daughter has a different last name, so it took a little bit of digging, but I found her pretty quickly. And I reached out and I said, I have the opportunity to work on this case, but I will never work on one of these without the family's blessing, because, you know, even if they at some point had desperately wanted it solved, for some people maybe opening that back up is too much or you know, something like that. And in this case, she said, I've been waiting my whole life for this. So
for somebody to come
and
she'd been waiting her whole life.
Yeah, those were her exact words. It was
Wow.
It's an emotional moment.
Yeah, it's emotional.
Yeah, so she's very involved. And in fact, a lot of the really valuable information.
She's a champion for her mother.
100%. Right? And in fact, the victim's mother is still alive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so,
daughter
and mother are both alive and both fully supportive and are giving us everything that we ask for whenever we say, hey, do you remember this person or do you remember that person? Man, they are all over it.
Is there, if we watch the shows and all that, right, it's based so much on technology as well, using, but you have to have had the samples. If you're going to use DNA and all that stuff, is that stuff there?
There's some.
Okay. Because, I mean, did we collect things before we knew we needed to collect them?
In some cases, people collected stuff way before they knew they needed to collect them, just sort of having the foresight that
smart investigators.
Or smart MEs and stuff, you know, who said someday these, you know, in some cases it's like slides, like actual like microscope slides and stuff where they're like, I just feel like someday this will, you know, science will advance. And so they're, you know, some
places. That's some foresight.
That's some real foresight. And in the early 90s, there was DNA testing starting to happen. It wasn't happening super widely yet, you know. And in Renee's case, there were a large number of samples collected, but they were not tested for DNA at the time.
Okay, we're up against a news break. Can you hang on with me? Can you stay?
Sure.
All right, coming right back.
There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby. That's right. This man knows what's up.
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along and continue our conversation with Sarah Kalian. She is going to be tonight, Iron Hand Brewery, doing an event starting at
7 p.m.
All right, and then Thursday night at the History Museum of Mobile.
Yep, 6 p.m. at the Historic Preservation Society of Mobile.
All right, and these discussions are about this. I want to land the plane on one thing. So we talked before we went to the break of people gathering information, gathering stuff that it becomes information in today's age, right?
Right.
That people had some foresight to gather stuff. So when you do cold case investigations, is part of that process going, heck, you got this stuff, you got one of those samples here, we got technology now that's, every 2 or 3 years it's super improved.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in the last 2 or 3 years with the advent of something called the MVAC, which is it is literally a wet vac for DNA. Like it looks like a small wet vac, and it pulls up what we call touch DNA, which is that, you know, literally I have picked up this coffee mug and I just put it back down. And if I walk out of here and you murder somebody with that, they're going to come talk to me because they're going to pull my touch DNA off of that thing. It's, you know, like the technology has gotten incredibly sophisticated, and the touch DNA was getting really sophisticated at the same time that we were fine-tuning the process of genetic genealogy, right?
Mapping
the marriage of these two things, right? And in fact, Mobile County is actually doing this. Olivia McCarter is someone who works with the sheriff's office, and that's sort of her area of expertise. So they can pull up old DNA samples and say, hey, Olivia, can you go to town and see if you can, kind of do the family tree matching on this and see if we can either find out who an unnamed victim was or find out, who was involved in something, and that's hats off, because that's something I have no mental bandwidth for, and it's definitely not my area of expertise. But then there are cases, we always hope that if we can close it quickly by pulling the DNA, mm-hmm. That'd be great. It gives some peace to the family. It gives some closure to the case, and we can move on to the next one, right? That isn't always the case, and sometimes it's really just good old-fashioned detective work.
Well, okay, and that's interesting because I don't know any – I don't even know if these stats are out there, but the number of cases of a serial murderer, rapist today that are solved versus what they were in the 1980s. And you had said something during the break that there was a period of time that was probably – the heyday, right?
Yeah, academically, it's referred to as the golden age of serial killers.
Okay,
which
I'll let you do that.
Meant a little bit tongue in cheek, but yeah, when they've always been around. Let me make that perfectly clear. They have always been around. They will always be around.
Always been around, as in, I mean, people could say, well, yeah, Sherlock Holmes was always busy on those, but was it medieval time? I mean, always been around? Y'all think it's always been part of the human condition?
Part of the human condition has always been that there are violent sociopaths and violent psychopaths for whom this is their, you know, that all of the conditions came together into the perfect storm, right?
So we didn't have to move into huge cities. We didn't have to have TV. Nope. We didn't have to have PCBs in the water or any of those things.
One of the most common questions I get is, are you a believer in nature versus nurture, mm-hmm. right? Which one? And my answer is just yes.
Yeah, both.
Because it takes all of these things. And when we, you know, look at the Venn diagram, that little tiny section in the center of you know, environment, possible physical trauma, emotional abuse or whatever, and then just your genetic predisposition, your hard wiring mm-hmm. towards sociopathy or psychopathy, which there are just a small percentage of them in humans like that. Mm-hmm. They're always going to be like that. That when all of the right pieces come together, that is when we get this particular brand of monster. So yeah, they've always
around.
Existed, and they always will.
So there was a period of time.
The 70s through the 90s are what we talk about with the golden age, and it is. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit tonight.
Okay.
So I don't want to give too much away because I
Once
want you guys to come
Iron Hand
to
Brewery
come
tonight,
to
yes.
Iron Hand and hear some of this. But there were some factors, particularly in America post World War II, where boys who were born during the decade of the 1940s would have had extra little nurture boosts to feed. On the nurture side, there were some extra things that were very, very common in the decade of the 1940s that then probably boosted the numbers that we then saw as they aged into adulthood. So that's why, you know, when we look back at it, we see so many in the 70s and 80s especially.
That's that cohort.
Yeah.
I think that's the science term, cohort.
Yes, it absolutely is. You're correct.
So you got a chance a little bit, at least the way it looks to me, is to have a time machine. As this new technology is out here, when we're outside of that golden age, to travel back and maybe right some wrongs.
I mean,
you now have this ability to go back. Like we often would say, if we could go back in history and change this, this, and this, wouldn't it have been better? Or brought justice to this and that?
Right.
You kind of get a chance to do that in a way.
You do get a little bit of a chance to do that. That's sort of the idea. There's sometimes some frustration with it too, because sometimes you look at a case and say, if they knew what we know now, they could have solved this in, you know, hours or days rather than somebody who was just left to their own devices for years to keep killing and killing.
You can now. You have that ability to – you can't stop it. But to try to bring justice.
Right. And you know, when I went back to school and when I did my master's work, what I was actually – like sort of the focus of my master's thesis was actually about preempting some of it, right? So a way to identify these guys earlier in their criminal process. So not Minority Report. We're not talking about, you know, locking
What's in
people
your brain?
Up.
Right.
Because we think they might do this.
Right.
But once they have committed the first couple of acts that are eligible in any criminal justice system in the country for long-term incarceration or, you know what I mean, like required to remove them from society,
right.
How can we catch them a little bit faster so that, you know, we might not be able to save that first victim, but maybe we can save the second through the 10th before this guy gets caught.
Yeah, just looking at some of the texts here, Terry earlier said, just from reading news accounts, it's pretty obvious that this was not Renee's killer's first rodeo. I mean, that there was something, at least that Terry's saying from remembering back then, that it seemed to him that that was a serial killer.
Yeah, it has a lot of components. Renee's case, as we've dug in, and it is part of the reason that it's taking some time. Although, like I said, 2 years on a cold case is not that bad. Yeah. There are some other nuance. Like when I first looked at it, that was my thought too. Was 100%. I need to go to the what's called the FGCU Redford database, which is like literally a database of serial killers in the world that was created at these two universities, and find these markers in this. You know what I mean? Like try and narrow down.
Is it
down.
Like an Excel file? Like you could.
It is literally an Excel file for that one. Now, not everybody has access. You have to.
No,
you know,
I
get
understand that.
Right.
But it works like an
Excel file, and you go in, and so like I was looking for. Or mutilations and decapitations and particular posings and stuff like that to see if it matched up with anybody who was active and known active at the time. And we did find one.
Wow.
Yeah. Sean Gillis out of Baton Rouge was active at the time, and he had a number that looked nearly identical to Renee's.
Wow. So you can find, and it's, you say it matter of factly, and it's honest. I'm not criticizing, but
sure.
That's active. It's like, in a way, that they're active at that time. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a term of art. I mean, that's how we phrase it.
They were active.
They
were doing their thing. This is the kind of way they like to. And is it regulated in like most of the cases, or is it chaotic in how they? Because it seems like you hear a lot of discussion about serial killers. They wanted to do it this way. Like there were rules to it in their mind.
Right.
Or a script.
Some of this has been tweaked a little bit over the years. But the fundamental line is, going back to the basics of when profiling was first being developed by Ann Burgess, John Douglas, and Robert Ressler. They categorized two different things, disorganized and organized.
Okay.
And some of them will have features. Some of them will have a little bit of a feature of one more than the other. Some of them are very hard in one camp. And some will progress as they go through
like
their career.
Like a bell curve? There's people on either end and
exactly,
majority somewhere.
Exactly. But that's how we describe them, as organized and disorganized.
So that's a thing.
That's absolutely a thing. Yep.
Wow. Let's see. A lot of these I may ask during the break. I don't know if they're... pretty tough. Obviously, I'm not worried about Sarah. She does this. I'm worried about all the rest of us. I mean, how does this not get to you?
It does. Of course it does.
I mean...
Yeah.
People talk about taking their work home with them.
Yeah.
I can't imagine doing what you do and taking your work home with you.
There is... of course I do. And in a case like this, especially where I've gotten close with the victim's daughter, which is, of course, you know, it's a giant...
Did you become friends with family members?
Yeah. And I'm still very close with the Bible family out of the Oklahoma case, you know. It can be really emotional. I'm pretty good. I mean, I've been in law enforcement in some capacity or another for 25 years. I'm also kind of, like, I've always been good under a crisis. So I'm like, I can compartmentalize pretty mm-hmm. well. But I do find myself, and I've gotten good at recognizing when I'm reaching a saturation point where I feel more tense. I feel more upset. I feel much more reactive to what I'm seeing, and I'm not looking at something, you know, as objectively as possible. Or even I'll feel it in other areas of my life, where like snapping at the kids or whatever. And so what I do in those moments, and I usually, because my work days will sometimes be, you know, just, you know, 5 or 6 hours working on something. Some days are 12 or 14. And as I hit that saturation point, I recognize it now. And I step away and I do what I call an emotional shower, which usually involves watching like Cougar Town or New Girl or something, you know, or rom-coms and stuff. Just completely like I close out all the browsers on my computer and just watch something really, really easy the brain.
Well, because this other part of it, and we probably have time here after the break to discuss it more, is what you do is what a lot of people think they want to do. Or they're fascinated with the true crime podcasts, cold cases. This is huge.
Yeah.
This is if you look at the top podcast on planet Earth, I think you only get to number three before it's a true crime podcast. It's like Rogan, it's like the New York Times podcast, and then it's a true crime podcast.
It's just
number
a, then
three.
It's just a then it's a, the rest of the list is all true crime podcasts.
Right, right.
Like, yeah.
You know, it's what you have as a as what you do for a living, this thing that you have to deal with the real part of it when you go home. To a lot of people, it's an obsession of – I hate to use this word. I'm going to use it and you can correct me. It's entertainment.
Right. There is an element of that, and there always has been. One of the things I really – I get a kick out of when I examine really old cases, because in a lot of these events, a lot of these shows like Tonight and Thursday, I like to explore really old cases like 17, 1800, stuff right. like that. And I will find in media reports and in old photographs as we get to like the turn of the 20th century, there are always crowds. There are always like gobs of people. We have not changed.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think is the most interesting about that is – that if you look in the photos or you hear like the accounts of people clamoring to get a seat in a courtroom and stuff,
as it is now,
it was overwhelmingly women. Just the same back then as it is right now.
You have any theories on that?
Oh, yeah. No, okay. Absolutely.
Can we hold those over the news break? See, that's what we call a tease. We're going to come back. And a reminder, too, you get to hear Sarah talk about this in person here in Mobile twice this week, tonight and Thursday night. We'll talk more about that when we come back and get your text and calls at 343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along and great to continue our conversation with Sarah Kalian. She has an event tonight coming up at Iron Hand Brewery later this week at the History Museum of Mobile. I got a lot of questions here for you, too.
Sure.
But I want to ask one of mine before I get to y'all's on the text line here. Talking about what you do. And, you know, you had a great analogy, too, because I said, you're like a pro sports player to some people. I'm going to tread lightly, but I think these things are true.
Sure.
So I'm going to say, what you do in cold case investigations and all that, for a lot of people, like the women, hadn't changed since the 1700s to now.
90% female.
Would love to do what you do.
Yep.
They think they would love to do what you do. There's a lot of us, guys and gals, that will look at like a star athlete and go, I'd love to be out there throwing that football, or I'd love to be the best in, you know, downhill skiing or whatever it is. But we didn't commit the time to do this. So I want to say this to you. I mean, you talked a little bit and kind of breezed through it. You spent how long doing this?
Almost 25 years now total.
This is your life.
Yeah, like when I first entered the Federal Police Academy in 98, but even prepping for that, going back a little bit further. So, yeah, 23 and a half, 24 years.
I mean, people think they want to do something and don't realize the time that athletes commit or somebody does what you commit, whatever it is, the time to build the skill set. So what is it? How does it strike you when you almost have a crowdsource investigation going on online every week, it seems like?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to listen to the podcast. We're going to figure out who did it.
That's a big – it's sort of like it's a big door in the kind of the many-roomed house of true crime, especially, or even in criminal investigations at large, is the idea of, you know, citizen detective, which I say with air bunnies because I hate that term.
Well, but is it a better thing, or is it better or worse for the process to bring – now, I know for, like, law enforcement as it goes, they love the fact that people can identify somebody on Facebook or look at it. Hey, I got video from my Ring doorbell or something like that. I'm helping out law enforcement.
Right.
But in this case, is it a benefit or a detriment?
Yes. Again, to answer that question. So if somebody is familiar at all with the true crime world out there, especially the podcasting realm, then you know that there is a whole range of styles. And some of them are professional journalists or professional investigators who just happen to, you know, work with a production company to create something, right? And then at the other end, you have people who are making a podcast in their basement or their kitchen table, and they've never investigated anything, but they're going to give it a shot. And then there's this kind of like huge world in between where it's kind of a combination of those two things. things. And there are plenty that are really just about retelling cases, right? There's a right. whole genre of true crime that is just kind of like fancy Wikipedia reading. And I don't knock that. There are plenty of those shows that I enjoy.
You get a better understanding probably than you did from the actual news account.
Sure, exactly. But in terms of investigative work being done by civilians, there are some great benefits to be had, and sometimes, you know, I mean, I know in the Gabby Petito case, there was this thing that in terms of her being, or the, you know, something like was located or identified out there mm-hmm. in the park, and that was done by civilians, and they gave it, and they were out there actively like looking for it, and they found it and turned it over to the FBI, and that's great.
Can I offer you the flip side of that coin?
Please, because I was just about to offer the flip side.
What is the flip side?
So the flip side of that coin is you have people who have no understanding of what they're doing, of the damage they can do either to an investigation or to a victim's family or to themselves. I kind of got into it with a very well-known podcaster on Twitter a couple of weeks ago because he said, you know, oh, all these true crime podcasts and there's not enough of you out there knocking on doors. And I normally keep my mouth shut. Oh. Like, it's none of my business. But I had to say something. I was like, no, please don't go knock on doors. You don't know what the risks are to you or the responsibility you take on when you start that.
Okay, we're going
to
come back for the break and talk more about this. And maybe, you know, my worry is one side helps maybe and one side identifies Brian Laundry behind every corner, too. We'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. This is great. And by the way, yes, a whole nother conversation going on during the commercial breaks with Sarah and I and on air. Once again, you have a chance to two events this week. And then let's do this. If somebody wants to, like, maybe they can't make an event this week or they're finding out more about you because I want to read some of these texts, where do they go online? Where's, like, the repository for everything Sarah Kalian?
The repository for me is kalianinvestigations.com. And also, honestly, Twitter is where I do the bulk of my sort of social media. I'm on Instagram a bit. Like, I'll publicize an event on Instagram. And Facebook is really just for, you know, my right. personal
Twitter,
life. But Twitter,
we're the same. Twitter is
pretty active on Twitter. Yeah. And my website does have all upcoming events. So if you are, you know, not able to make it this week, but you happen to be in Philadelphia or Boston or Chicago or Atlanta in the next couple of weeks, you can take a peek at the website. And I've got events in all those cities.
I get a lot of questions here, Sarah. Okay, so that's one we talked about during the break with that St. Elba story, but this is an interesting question. Fred asks, have you ever worked with a medium or mediums like Alison Dubois? That's Fred asking. Have you gone that route?
No.
Nope.
Sorry, and I love the show Medium that is based around Alison Dubois, but
I'm like the great person to talk to because I've never seen any of these shows.
Yeah,
so I'm ignorant.
It was a little older, and it was a dramatization, but it was sort of about Alison Dubois' life. And to be completely clear, I personally do believe in ghosts, and I think there's probably something to be had there. I don't deny the value of it, but I personally have not.
Okay, well, let's get into my world. Okay, here's my... So Fred had that. Mine is, I think it is, it's Terry asking, what about how often do you use genealogy DNA? Somebody earlier asked, do you use ancestry.com, that kind of stuff?
Right. So I personally do
now,
not.
Now we're in my realm.
That is a particular type of expertise that I just, you know, I don't have.
Do you ever call on somebody?
100%. Yeah. And like I said, in Mobile County Sheriff has somebody that they call on, Olivia McCarter, who is only like 20 years old. She's so young and so smart. And she's really good at that. And she's actually solved a couple of cold cases for Mobile County using the genetic genealogy. So, yeah. So, again, Mobile County Sheriff's Office is all over this, y'all.
It's quite impressive. And the dream team we brought together here with you and others to work on these cold cases. So you have the genealogy part of this. You have this profiling that you're talking about. I mean, it seems like the enhancement and ability to tackle cases that come up today is... Is it a sea change from 1980 to today? Is it a 10% better? Is it a 50?
It's potentially exponentially better.
Okay.
The biggest problem in my opinion is just time. You know, it's having dedicated people, right? Having dedicated people who can spend 2 years on a cold case, or you know, a couple of days if you get lucky and it hits the DNA and it hits the GED match, and you know, which is the system that uploaded from places like Ancestry and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a question of having dedicated people who just sort of, that's their full-time job, and they're not getting pulled away by current stuff. And that's
why is
honestly one of the reasons that I'm a big proponent of police agencies bringing somebody like me in. I just kind of can hum along in the background like an OS. Hey,
you're
and
not
going to
get called out. You don't get called out.
Right,
you're, like,
exactly.
You're not going, you know, they're not saying that, hey, we got a current case that's going, you're not working there.
Exactly. And then when I need somebody, you know, and in this case, it's usually Detective Matt Peake is usually who I bug at, you know, all hours to say, hey, we need to go talk to this guy. And you know, and he almost always does it. He's a good sport.
There you go. Don says, I'm thankful for people like Sarah. I have the spirit that allows for accountabilities for families who have experienced such excruciating pain in their life. And I believe her job is of biblical proportion.
Aww.
She has a calling, and thank you.
Thank you. That really means a lot.
So Chris says, my grandmother has been missing since November of 2016. How does one propose a cold case to be investigated? So I guess this is Mobile County, Chris. I don't know.
Yeah, we would need to find out what the jurisdiction is.
I can't imagine. Chris, my heart breaks. I can't imagine.
Yeah, 100%. And if it's, I mean, you know, I would need more details than this to know exactly what direction to point you
Maybe
in.
You can reach out privately.
100%. Yeah. If you go onto my website, there's a form for contact. You know what I mean? Like one of those Dropbox forms. And you can click on there and send me what you've got, and I'll see if I can help point you in the right direction.
All right. Get more coming in on this, but something we were talking about before we went to the news was this idea of it being a benefit or a detriment, having this kind of group think about
hive mind.
Yeah, hive mind. There you go, hive mind on it. And I mean, I guess if there was a way to filter it, I mean, there's certain things, like people's brains work differently. So after 9/11, they reached out to certain people and who they thought maybe brains worked asymmetrically and asked us to come up with
Yeah, 100%. And this is the critical point, is that different people's expertise offer different things to something. And one of my kind of quibbles with law enforcement, and I experienced this myself, you know, for many years and working in a department and stuff, is this sectioning off, this kind of need to know basis. And there is real importance to that for a lot of reasons, but it is also worth exploring what somebody else can bring to the table. And that's one of the reasons that I do enjoy, you know, and I say a lot of nice stuff, but I'm really not blowing smoke. It's unusual for an agency to say, we think you have this one little area that you can bring to the table and look at the case differently than everybody who's looked at it before that, and being open to that. Because we know this from 9/11, right? That these agencies weren't even talking to themselves and
right.
each other, never mind reaching out to civilian experts. And so, yeah, there is real value in having fresh eyes who just have a different view on life looking at something, because they'll often see something that even I never noticed, because I still have spent most of my life in law enforcement.
Yeah, and looking at where the hive mind is, one of them we talked about before we went to the break, and this audience knows I've not spent a whole bunch of time on it. It's kind of the Gabby Petito story. Mm-hmm. You have this thought process of what could have happened, but then you almost have the flip side of the national manhunt here going
right.
on that leads people to think that the possible murderer
corner.
Everywhere.
Yeah,
they busted in doors somewhere the other day. I think law enforcement had to kick in a door on a report in a hotel room. A guy that.
Oh, I didn't even hear about that one.
Yeah.
I did hear that there was a man hiking who really does look like him. I saw the picture on the Appalachian Trail, and they brought him down at gunpoint and cuffs, and this poor guy, you know, and that's an unfortunate incident, and I hope that he is fine. And I'm sure probably he understands that you know, right, that no harm was intended to him, and was probably sent on his merry way afterwards. But I think we talked about this at the break, that there is a lot of time spent being scared of very, very minute detail things, uh-huh, in these huge, like, publicized cases, when in reality, even the guys that I study look very different most of the time in real life, and often they are lurking around corners and you don't know they're there. So, like, I don't want people scared,
but
I do want them aware. They're everybody.
No, who are they? They're everybody. They're male.
They're everybody.
They're male.
They're male.
They're male, number one.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
99.99 or 100% of the time.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I when I say these guys and these men, and
you mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's males.
It's males.
So does the, you know, this question about the nature versus nurture and this formula, the what's in your code, and then you add these exacerbating, yep, circumstances on top of it. Why didn't that happen in females?
Women tend to internalize aggression rather than externalize it. And that does have primarily to do, not exclusively, but primarily to do with nurture, right? So when women, and obviously we see stuff like child abuse and stuff, mm-hmm, like that women can perpetuate. But say you look—
But at much lower rates, right?
I don't know enough about the most recent statistics on that to give an answer one way or the other, and I don't want to give bad information. I do know that in domestic violence, it's 2 to 3 to 1 on, you know, on males, male perpetrators, yep, versus female. I think it's probably closer for child abuse, but even that tends to be a reflection of women internalizing anger and directing it at something that is much closer to them, and internalizing violence. And so a lot of times, if you see where a guy is going to blow his top and, you know, punch somebody out at a bar, and in, mm-hmm, that case, we're not talking about, you know, sociopathy or anything,
right,
like that. We're just
passion,
talking about regular,
right,
yeah, like, yeah,
crime
regular
passion,
violence. Yeah. Women are much more likely to commit self-harm. Yes, or to, you know, develop eating disorder stuff. Like, and it's all part of the same brain function.
Just manifests.
It just manifests very differently.
You had said something, I think we were talking during the break, and this is away from these kind of killings, but the mass killing, mm-hmm, right? These horrible shootings at a school or a mall or a, mm-hmm, concert or something like that. And that maybe to a T, or am I misquoting you, that you go back and look at these people, there's domestic violence.
I've never found one yet that didn't have it.
And not a one.
Not one. I mean, not one that I've looked. You know,
no,
what I mean? Like, every,
right,
time one pops,
yes,
up in the news, I go poke around and look at this and that. There it is. Or they started out with the family. So you look at the Sandy Hook shooter, mm-hmm, where he killed his mom first and,
yep,
then went to the school. And we've seen a number of those. It is the single biggest predictor of mass violence is domestic violence.
But acting out on domestic violence or having domestic violence foisted on them?
Oh, acting out on it, that they are the perpetrators of domestic violence.
So if domestic violence happens to them, it doesn't really, it's them showing it themselves, not that it's happening to them in the home.
Right. At least when we're talking about mass violence, and, mm-hmm, this accounts for a lot of serial killers too, we are, we're looking at they exhibited this behavior at home. Now, yes, when we talk about the serials, a lot of times there was, and probably with the mass too, there might have been an abusive childhood growing up and stuff like that. But,
right,
what creates a, you know, like a mass shooter, or even sometimes these ones who are like mass stabbings or driving into crowds,
Norway,
and stuff like that,
yeah,
where there is a sort of, you know, what we call a lone wolf quality, although it's rarely turns out that they were completely, you know, unaware to everybody around them. But the psychology of that is very much tied in with the same psychology. I mean, it is a direct one-to-one correlation in committing acts of domestic violence themselves.
So when you reverse engineer, if that's even, sure, the right term of these situations, you end up at the same place.
Yeah.
In these cases.
Yeah.
There was some domestic violence acted out before it left the house. It was with a closer.
Yep. And sometimes for years leading up to it as well. One of the most famous and sort of one of the canary in the coal mine mass violence incidents was the the shooting at the McDonald's in, I want to say San Bernardino, in California, San Ysidro, sorry. And it was this sort of like 42-minute long hostage situation. And he shot up the entire place and killed kids and old people. And he had an extensive history of domestic violence. Same with the D.C. The main guy in the D.C. sniper. Yeah. Although Malvo was the kid, right? It was the other one.
Yeah, the one driving. Yeah,
the older guy, extensive history of intense domestic violence. It's we saw these guys before we started sort of, I hate to say, getting used to these incidents, but they've been around too, and we saw the same predictive factors.
All right, coming right back, another segment here, and a reminder of the events where you can see Zara in person tonight and Thursday night when we return on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
It's been a lot of fun, and enjoying our conversation with Sarah Kaelin. You have a chance tonight to hear even more in-depth Iron Hand Brewery, right?
7 p.m. at Iron Hand.
So tickets ahead of time, but we can just show up? What's the vibe
on
tickets?
You can show up. I'm pretty sure. So just in my own defense, I let venues handle their own ticketing and stuff like that. They bring me in, they host me, and then they handle that. My understanding is it's cheaper if you buy them in advance. I want to say it's like $15 or $20 if you buy them in advance, and then like $5 more at the door.
Okay.
And then I think for the Historical Preservation Society, it's a flat ticket price of $25. It's a lot of fun. It's a couple hours of this stuff.
And we could do both because it's different subjects. Tonight
sure
and on Thursday night.
Tonight is all Halloween cases, and we are going to talk a little bit about the golden age of the serial killers and maybe why some of them were the way they were. And then the Thursday night, because it's the Preservation Society, we're going to talk about all Gulf Coast crimes. It's called Blood on the Bayou.
I asked you this last time. Are we, let's take the Gulf Coast, let's go Corpus Christi to Tampa or something.
Right.
Is this a hot zone compared to other strips around the country? Are we more or less than...
I don't think so. I mean, I think every region feels a little like that. Like, obviously, the Pacific Northwest thinks they've got the lock on serial killers. But I grew up in Gainesville, Florida, and I lived through both Bundy and Danny Rowling. You know, so, but I will say this. When I've been researching, especially the historical cases, I've never seen so many axe murderers as in the Gulf Coast stuff.
So
you guys really got a good lock on the axe murderers.
Yikes. Terry's asking, law enforcement folks here, Terry's saying, what was your first law enforcement job?
So very, very first, and just for a hot minute, I was with the Department of the Interior as an agent for the National Park Service, but pretty quickly transitioned out of that to a municipal agency. I did the bulk of my commissioned work with a little city called Groveport. It's a suburb of Columbus, Ohio, and that's where I did the bulk of my time on regular duty.
You mentioned National Park Service. We don't have time because we have 6 minutes left here. Did I ask you last time about that? I forget the term here, but it's a zone— in West Yellowstone, it's this murder triangle where by the nature of where it is, they can't see if you killed somebody there, and I'm going to have it, and I could Google it, and I'll Google it afterwards, but it's an area where if you killed somebody there, because of jurisdiction of the Park Service and the two states, you couldn't see the jury to...
Yeah. Actually, I don't think you and I talked about that. I feel like somebody else asked me about that more recently. And I think I have faith in our law enforcement system that there is a way around that and that it has been found. It may have been a loophole that some defense attorney
brought it up. It was an academic.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. Yellowstone Park. It says.
But if it's in the park, then it's National Park Service, and so it's federal jurisdiction, and you really don't want to mess with federal courts.
Yeah, they said, it's called the 50 square mile zone of death, I guess. But it was a theory. It was a political theory. I mean,
an academic theory
on it. That was just interesting working at the Park Service and all. How many cases? I mean, I think most recently Gabby Petito, but
sure.
I mean, is there something to do with it? I guess the wide open spaces or?
I don't know that there's any more than there are in any other necessarily wide open spaces. There's some weird stuff with parks. Like park officers actually find more people who have died by suicide than, you know, mm-hmm. than other areas and stuff, because people tend to sometimes, you know, go someplace that's peaceful to them and remote. No, but there are some really good ones. There are some really fascinating cases. And actually, you've just given me the idea that I obviously need to do a show entirely about National Park Service, you know, national park crimes.
I'm thinking there's been some of these that...
Well, the Blue Ridge Parkway, there was the serial killer that was killing people at the rest stops in the parkway in I want to say the 70s and 80s.
The Golden Age.
The Golden Age, baby. See, you're learning something already. This is what I do. I like to teach people stuff, but I make them, you know, not realize they're learning.
No, I like that. And I think that's why, so many people will come out tonight and Thursday night because they feel like they're getting an education, something they want to, you know, it's funny, like when we get to be adults, we're like, wow, I should have paid more attention in school. Yeah. Like, I'm fascinated by these things that were offered to me, but I was too busy writing notes or something.
What is it they say? Youth is wasted on the young. Education is wasted on the young, too.
Guaranteed, for sure. Now, your relationship with Mobile County Sheriff's Office, we talked about that. So a couple times a month, you're coming in, right?
Over the course of the last 2 years, it's probably averaged out to once a month for you know, anywhere between 1 week and 3 weeks, depending on what we've got going on. It's been a little more sporadic this summer just because things have been crazy.
But it's not specific to, like, we're talking about the Bergeron case, but it can be more cases going down. Like, when this is, let's hopefully we find resolution here. Will you still be with us and helping?
Sure hope so. Okay. As long as I haven't annoyed the heck out of the major crimes guys, and as long as Captain Birch will keep having me back, and, you know, hopefully someday Sheriff Birch will keep having me back. I will keep doing it. I love working with this team. I'm really proud, and I'm really honored that they've kind of made me part of the team.
All right, we'll see you tonight and Thursday night, Sarah. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much, Sean.
All right, Paul Feinbaum show on the way. Talk to y'all tomorrow for another edition of Midday Mobile right here on FM Talk 106.5, online fmtalk1065.com. And hey, did I mention we have an app? Just go search it at the App Store for iPhone users or on Google Play for Android users, FM TALK 1065. I think you're going to love it. All right, be good.